welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time. Hello, Rob Greaves once again hosting another fabulous Listen to Older Voices program. I talk with so many people with wonderful stories, and once again, I'm going to bring you a story of an amazing woman who has and continues to overcome serious adversity and whose story is both inspirational and fascinating. Patricia, better known as Pat, was born in 1947 in Evesham, Worcestershire, Britain. With undiagnosed dyslexia, she was labelled stupid and once locked in a school cupboard for punishment and forgotten. As we'll hear over the next 3 weeks, whilst dyslexia is a form of learning handicap, it was neither a barrier or an excuse for Pat. We listen in amazement of her story growing up and her philosophy on bringing children up. With considerable artistic talent and desire to go into that area, she was forced by her parents into a proper job. Listen for the story about the gypsy who accurately foretold her future and Pat's amazing sea voyage to Australia. You'll be glued to your radio. So, without any more ado, here I am, speaking with Pat. Can I begin by asking you, when were you born and whereabouts were you born?
I was born in 1947, 13th of June, in my grandmother's home in the Vale of Evesham.
Where's Evesham for people that are listening that don't know England?
It's a Worcestershire area. It was a big market gardening area. All the fruit and veggies were grown in that area. It was a very rich valley, and we had hills right around us.
So you were brought up in a fairly healthy environment.
Yes. My family had been market gardeners for centuries. I've got photographs going back into the early 1800s of a 300-acre farm that was owned by the family. And then over the years, I mean, land got lost or sold off, or we did have a family member that used to gamble quite severely, and we lost a lot of the land that way.
Oh, that's a story that gets told many times. There's always the what they call the black sheep in the family.
Oh, yes. Yeah. There was five brothers. One went to South Africa, went into mining. The other one went to America, had something to do with Colesville that was done that there. One went to New Zealand. One came out here to Australia, which is part of G.J. Coles. I'm related to them. Not because they want to know me, but yep. And the last one was left at home, and he paid off his brother's debts. So consequently, the family lost everything. He paid off the debts and he stayed at home, and so I'm part of that generation.
Going back into those early days, on those early years, what are some of your earliest memories?
I suppose working on the land. I've sort of brought up with the land. I mean, my family, because my parents were living with my father's parents, and so when I was born, then we moved out to the country to a little place called Bevington Waste. And it was a tiny little place. We lived on a Lady Eleanor's estate. My father was one of the gardeners for her. And so I spent most of my life in the woods, running around on a three-wheel bike with a double-barrel pop gun under my arm, riding up the road after the horses and hounds when they went through. But we used to raise pigs, and it was the days when you did everything yourself, you know, and the butcher would come in and he'd take the pigs away to market, and we always had one that would come back as a side of bacon, which hung in the pantry. It was dried out and you kept it. All the fruit and veggies, my mother had them in bottles and jars and big clay pots in the pantry, so we had our own stuff. But my mother was not a land person. And the pigs got out one day because she would persist in going in the pig pen and tipping the slop in the tray instead of in the chute from the outside. And the pigs got off. And my father said, I must have been about 3 years old at the time. And it's the first part that I remember of being up there, of running around with a big stick chasing the pigs back into the pen while my mother's running down the road. I must have a thing with animals. That's probably why I've still got so many around me.
You keep mentioning Mum. What sort of person was she?
Lovely. She was a lovely lady, and she still is. Yeah, she's gorgeous. She's still alive.
She's still alive.
She's 87 years old, and that's why we have five generations in the family. Yes.
Wow.
So she has a great grandson. Yeah, she's thrilled to bits. Yeah, and yeah, she was a very quiet lady. You know, just went about her things, and then when we moved back into the township, she went back to work, and I used to go to school, come back, and stay with my grandparents till she got home from work. But in those days, it was safe for children to walk around the streets and do whatever. So at a certain time, my grandmother would say to me, okay, it's time for Mum to get out of work. So off I'd trot down the road and go and stand outside the factory and wait for her to come out.
Not a second thought.
No.
No.
Didn't even think twice about it. You know.
Now, you mentioned school, and I'd like to talk to you about your school experiences. But before I do that, I guess we should address this, the gender balance here, and talk a little bit about Dad. What do you remember about Dad in the early days?
I don't know. He was always away at work.
What did he do? You mentioned he worked on an estate.
He worked on the estate as a gardener, because he'd been brought up on the land. You know, he'd worked on the land with his parents. I mean, from what he told me, I mean, he would get up, he would go to and work a couple of hours on the land in the morning, and then he'd go to school, and then when he finished school, he'd go back out and he'd work on the land until dark. I mean, that's what most kids did, that, you know, that had a family business, and when you were working on the land, I mean, you had no choice.
Mm.
And it was funny, because only recently I was talking to him about this, and he said he got into trouble at school so often for being late in the morning. And in those days, you've got the cane or you've got the strap across your hands. And every morning he would stand there and put his hands out, and he would get this belt in for being late for school again. And there was a group of them that used to come in late. And he said to the teacher said to him, I cannot understand this. He said, you are such a good student. You pass in everything. He said, but you're late every morning with these bad boys. He said, what are you doing with them? He said, I don't come with them. He said, well, why are you always late? He said, well, he said, I have to get up at 5. He said, and I go and work on the land. He said, and I don't finish there till 8:30. And then I have to run home and get changed and have a wash and then get back to school. He said, when I finish school, I go back and I work on the land until dark. He said, why have you never told me this before? He said, you never asked. So
the teacher
gave him a clemency that he could be there a little bit later, you know, but
that says a lot about the respect your father must have had for the teacher or teachers, and I guess the respect kids had, because he never spoke up. He was, you know, here he was with the perfect explanation, but just took it as it came, the punishment.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. That's something which is...
Yes.
Just doesn't happen today, does it? Kids just don't have that sort of...
No, yeah. My father has real problems with kids nowadays because of that, I think, because he said they have no respect for their parents. They have no respect for what their parents have done for them and what their grandparents have done for them. They've had everything just handed to them. And he said that's, you know, things weren't like that.
Yes. I remember when I was young, one of the things I used to hate was listening to grown-ups talk about how better it was in their days and how kids were better in their days. And you used to think, oh, here we go again. But when you get older, you realise that there was something in what was being said, because that was the beginning of where we are today. The fact that...
Well, yes.
I mean, it's probably wrong to try and generalise that every kid that's like that. But there seems to be a growing number that are constantly in trouble. Our society sees this day by day, whether it's hanging on the back of trains, whether it's graffiti, whether it's the violence. And it must be coming from somewhere. And it all, you know, there's an old saying, it starts in the home. And if you're not, don't get that respect.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I have 13 grandchildren, and I look at them and I can sort of separate them out. And they've all been taught the same. One group have gone off and been really good and settled themselves well, and then you have this other little group on the other side that you think, they'll never make it.
Yeah.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by. And so, become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
And give up tender years, can't know the fears that your elders grew by, and so please help them with your youth. They see the truth before they can die.
Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, Ageless Stories on Ageless Radio.
So what about you as a child? Did you enjoy going to school?
Yes. Yes, I did. I had lots of friends. I found it hard, and it was many years later I found out that I was dyslexic. So I didn't realise that I had a problem. So I was always in problem because I couldn't read properly and I couldn't write properly. And so in those days too, there was always punishment. So, yep, I copped that a lot.
Yes.
Did with my parents. And it wasn't until much later, till one of my nephews was actually diagnosed with dyslexia, that I suddenly realised that I had a problem.
Did you attempt to sort of reconcile this as a child, your inability to do things like other kids? Did you ever think you were just stupid or?
Yes. Yes, I did. I was very introverted as a child because of that.
Yeah.
I was stupid. And in those days, you were still sat in the corner with a big dunce cap on. Or the other thing that my teacher would do is she would lock you up in one of the lockers. And she actually did that to me one day for not doing something correct, and I can't even remember what it was. Now, it was so long ago, but I remember being locked in the locker, and she'd forgotten she'd put me there, and the class went home.
Oh, no.
And my parents came home from work, and their thing was, where's Pat? She hasn't come home, you know. So they went to my grandparents. They said she never came here from school. So there was a panic. My father went to the headmistress because he knew where she lived, and she said, I didn't see her, so we will go to her teacher. So they went up the road to my teacher, and my teacher went, oh, I locked her in the cupboard. Oh, my goodness. Yep.
Were your parents angry?
Oh, fuming. In fact, I think my father actually hit the teacher. He was so angry. And I've suffered with claustrophobia since then too.
Oh, surprise, you know,
because
surprise.
I'd been locked in there from lunchtime until my parents came home, which would have been after they'd finished work. So I probably wasn't found till about 6:30, 7 o'clock that night. So, yeah, so don't shut me in small places. I get quite panicky.
Well, with good reason.
Yep.
I mean, I think that's something we could follow for hours talking about that, but I think there's a lot more to your story. You mentioned you had a lot of friends at school. What did you do? What was your way of entertainment?
I have a weird sense of humour. I love cemeteries. And I would go and listen about all these tales about ghosts and spooks and things like that. So I got a group together once because there was an old tale of, because we had a big monastery in our town that had been knocked down by Henry VIII when he was having his
Reformation.
Yes. Yep. And there was a little cemetery that was like turned into a like a traffic island, because it was only small and it was just from the monks and it was just down the road from us. So it had this beautiful brick wall around it, and the road went round each side of it, and houses got built over the years. And there was an old story that if you went there on Halloween and you had to run six times one way and six times the other way, and then there was something you had to chant, which I can't even remember after all these years.
The kids have these rules. But yes. That's right.
So I'd put a ladder up against my bedroom window because we lived in a flat upstairs, and it was an electrician shop underneath us, and the ladders were always at the back, so I was up. So I climbed out of my window at 11:30 and met half a dozen other kids down at the cemetery, and we ran round one way and round the other, right on 12 o'clock and chanting and dancing in the cemetery, and nothing happened. And I went, well, this is disappointing, you know. So they used to have, some of the graves had like concrete boxes over the top of you. Have you ever seen that?
Yes.
You have so I got on top of it and danced and it gave way and I fell into the grave. Screaming my lungs out. And here's all my friends trying to get me out real quick before somebody came and grabbed us. So, yeah, we were home in a hurry.
Well, that's what you get for dancing. You see, around six times.
I look back on it now and I think, oh my goodness, you know, I was such a silly kid at times, you know. But we had freedom in those days. You didn't have to worry about being out at night and, right. and what else was running around with you, sort of thing, you know, out yes. there. Yeah.
Now, often, even if you don't know you've got something like dyslexia, the human body seems to find ways of compensating. Did you find that you could compensate in some way? Was there something in yes. the school that you were good at?
My artwork.
Art?
I won my first competition over the whole of Great Britain when I was 7 years old.
Wow, that's an achievement.
Yes. I've always been able to draw and been able to paint. And it was funny because when we first came out here too, there was a little advertisement on the back of a magazine, and it was for to do an art course. And if you managed to pass their exams, you would get into this University of Art. So unbeknownst to my parents, I very carefully filled it out with a dictionary to make sure that I got it all spelt correctly, they sent it out to me. I did all the drawings and paintings that I had to, sent it back. And then I received a letter, and because I couldn't read it properly, and my father picked it up and read it. And it was for me to go to the University of Art in Melbourne at the age of 10.
Who was more surprised, him or you?
Both of us, I think. I got a good belt in for doing it.
Well, that's some reward for excelling.
And was told that there was no way I was going to do it because it was too expensive and they couldn't afford it. And yeah. My father had this impression that the word artist went with the word bum in those days, which was a lazy, good-for-nothing.
Yes, it wasn't a profession, it wasn't a job.
That's right, yeah. So consequently, nothing came of it, you know. And I mean, I actually got an apprenticeship as a commercial artist when I was, 15. And when I came home and told him that, oh, my goodness, I got another belt in for that one.
Well, okay.
He just didn't do those sort of things. He took me the next day down to a factory and started me working in Hollandia sewing up shoes.
Because that's a real job.
That's right.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, a program that presents the stories of everyday Australians through the recollection of their lives.
How was it that you came to Australia? And in asking you that, I happen to know that there's a story involving a gypsy.
Yes.
Would you like to share that one?
Okay. There was a big fairground in our local town. And I mean, we had a really old town where I came from. I mean, it goes back for centuries. and they had this big fair, would come in every year, and the gypsies would always come in because that's when they made their money with fortune telling and goodness knows what. But you usually had to go and pay them to do that. Now, my father was always telling me, don't get close
with the gypsies.
And this gypsy woman picked me out in the crowd, came up, stooped in front of me, and she looked at me and she said, you're going to go overseas to another country. You're going to take a long, long trip. I stood there, sort of
aghast,
stunned. Yeah. You know, I mean, little 10-year-old being told that she's going to go overseas. And I'm, you know, my father just looked at this person and whipped me away, quick smart, just left her.
You didn't have anything to do with gypsies then, did you?
No, right. You didn't play with the gypsies. You know, as children, we were always told all sorts of terrible things about them. And a fortnight later, we had a letter asking my father, was he still interested in immigrating to Australia? Now, it had been 10 years before he was even married, he'd put in papers for immigrating. So he wrote to them and said yes, and he now had a wife and a child. And 7 days later, we got papers, you know, to say that, yep, we were leaving in 7 days.
Wow.
We had 7 days to pack up the house and everything we had, and it was very hard because it was, you know, you can't take this and you can't take that. And we just had to pack a little bag, and we came onto the English £10 immigration system.
By boat or by plane?
By boat. I think it was 6 or 8 weeks it took to get here.
Do you remember any of that trip?
Yes. Oh, yes. We had a very interesting trip. I loved it. I thought it was fabulous because we watched dolphins and whales and goodness knows what. But at one stage we came, I don't know whereabouts we were, I'll be honest with you, I have no idea, in the middle of the ocean somewhere, and the ocean was like glass. It was so still, not a wave, not a ripple, nothing. I have never seen anything like it since in my whole life. And the people that were working on the boat were down on the front of the boat on their knees praying to Allah, I suppose it was, because I said to my father, what are they doing? What are those people doing down there? And he said, they're praying. I said, what for? He said, I don't know. None of us had any idea. And then the ocean started to change colour, and so did the sea. And you couldn't tell the difference of where the sea finished and the sky met. It went the same colour.
The sky went the same colour.
Yep, the sky and the ocean went the same colour, and like I said, it was like a sheet of glass. It was, and then it just erupted. And we were in the middle of a cyclone. Literally.
Oh, that's why it was so still.
Yes.
You kept your silence to the eye.
You know, you hear the still before the storm.
Yes,
well,
yes.
Alarms went off in the boat, and we all had to put life jackets on and go into our cabins, and we were locked in our cabins. It wasn't until I watched Titanic many years later I thought, oh, my goodness, we would have gone down with the boat.
Absolutely.
But as a kid, I was thrilled to bits. The boat was going up and down. It was great. My poor mother, you know, they say people turn green when they get sick. They really do. Oh, it's the first time I saw somebody turn really green. Wow. She spent the whole time in that storm clutching the sink, being sick.
And it didn't affect you?
No. I still don't get seasick.
Goodness.
Doesn't worry me at all. I love the sea. I find it very calming, actually. It's beautiful. But we were out there long enough to see a water spout go up, like a big twister, you know, that went. And we were just absolutely stunned, you know, and that's when they started yelling that everybody had to go inside, and apparently the boat changed course for a while. So,
for you, it was just an excitement and adventure.
Oh, yes, it was quite an exciting thing. It was incredible.
Where was the first place you actually got off the boat? Do you recall what state it was?
Perth. We got off in Perth, yep. We were supposed to land in Perth, and something happened with our papers. I don't know what happened. It was a big muddle up because we had made arrangements to meet someone from the church that my parents belonged to, and they met us in Perth, only to find out that our papers had been stamped Melbourne instead of Perth. So we weren't allowed to get off there. I remember being rather upset over the fact that I said to my parents, no, I don't have to learn a new language, do I? And they said, no, they speak English. And I went, beaut, beaut, I don't, because, I mean, not being able to read and write properly.
Yes.
Dyslexia is one of those things where language is just almost impossible.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I have real problems with it. So I'm thinking, good. And some people got on, and obviously they were farmers, which speak a completely different
the accent just threw you, yes.
The accent threw me, and people kept talking about these cockies, and I'm looking around and I can't find any birds, and I'm thinking, and then I'm watching there was some cows pulling wagons that were coming into the port, and I'm thinking, my goodness.
Where am I? Well, yeah, what century is this?
And I didn't understand a thing that was being said or what was being done, and I found it very distressing to start off with, you know. But, yeah, when we finally settled in Melbourne, we stopped at, originally it was the exhibition buildings. There used to be a lot of little huts behind the exhibition buildings.
That was a camp, wasn't it?
Yes, and that's where all the migrants came in.
Yes, I remember that.
I've got photographs of it somewhere of my parents and I stood outside the little hut.
I think it might have been a place called Camp Hill.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I know we had to go into the exhibition buildings, and that's where we were registered as we came in, and then they took us to one of these little huts at the back where we stayed. And we were there, I think, for about 2 weeks or so until they found us a migrant camp, and we were sent to Nunawading, to the big camp that was there.
Tune in next week for part two of Pat's amazing story, when we finish the story of her settling in Australia and learn how she met Vic, who became her husband and soulmate. We also listen to the terrifying and moving story of when her daughter went into convulsions and stopped breathing. Oh, there's all this and lots more next week. Pat Grotius on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.